Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The First Comer by B.M. Croker. I'm an old maid, and am not the least ashamed of the circumstance. Pray, why should women not be allowed the benefit of the doubt like men, and be supposed to remain single from choice? I can assure you that it is not from want of offers that I am Miss Janet McTavish, spinster. I could tell, but no matter. It is not to set down a list of proposals that have taken pen in hand, but to relate a very mysterious occurrence that happened in our house last spring. My sister Matilda and I are a well-to-do couple of maiden ladies, having no poor relatives and a comfortable private fortune. We keep 4 servants, all female, and occupy a large detached house in a fashionable part of Edinburgh, and the circle in which we move is most exclusive and genteel. Matilda is a good deal older than I am, though we dress alike, and is somewhat of an invalid. Our east winds are certainly trying, and last March she had a very sharp attack of bronchitis, brought on, between ourselves, by her own rash imprudence. Though I may not say this to her face, I may say it here. She does not approve of fiction, though goodness knows what I am going to set down is not fiction, but fact. But any literary work in a gay paper cover, of course I don't mean tracts, such as novels and magazines, is an abomination in her eyes, and reading such like trash she considers sinful waste of time. So, even if this falls into her hands, by an odd chance, she will never read it, and I'm quite safe in writing out everything that happened, as I dare not do if I thought that Maddie was coming after me and picking holes in every sentence. Matilda is terribly particular about grammar and orthography and reads over all my letters before I venture to close them. Dear me, how I have wandered away from my point. I'm sure that no one will care to know that I am a little in awe of my elder, that she treats me sometimes as if I were still in my teens. But people may like to hear of the queer thing that happened to me, and I am really and truly coming to it at last. Matilda was ill with bronchitis, very ill. Bella, that's our sewing maid and general factotum, who has been with us 12 years this term, and I took it in turns to sit up with her at night. It happened to be my night, and I was sitting over the fire in a half kind of doze, when Matilda woke up, and nothing would serve her but a cup of tea of all things, at 12 o'clock in the morning. The kitchen fire out, no hot water, and everyone in the house in their beds except myself. I had some nice beef tea in a little pan besides the hob, and I coaxed her hard to try some of that, but not a bit of it. Nothing would serve her but real tea, and I knew that once she had taken the notion in her head, I might just as well do her bidding first as last. So I opened the door and went out, thinking to take the small lamp, for of course all the gas was out, and turned off at the meter, as it ought to be in every decent house. "You'll no do that," she said, quite cross. Maddie speaks broad when she is vexed, and we had had a bit of an argument about the tea. "You'll no do that, and leave me here without the light. Just go down and infuse me a cup of tea as quick as ever you can, for I know I'll be awfully the better for it." So there was just nothing else for it, and down I went in the pitch-black darkness, not liking the job at all. It was not that I was afraid, not I. But the notion of having to rake up and make the kitchen fire and boil the kettle was an errand that went rather against the grain, especially as I'm a terrible bad hand at lighting a fire. I was thinking of this and wondering where were the wood and the matches to be found when, just as I reached the head of the stairs, I was delighted to hear a great raking out of cinders below in the kitchen. Such a raking and poking and banging of coals and knocking about of the range I never did hear, and I said to myself, "This is fine. It's washing morning. We do our washing at home, and later than I thought, and the servants are up, so it's all right." And I ran down the kitchen stairs, quite inspirited, like by the idea. As I passed the door of the servants' room, where cook and housemaid slept, Harris, that's the housemaid, called out, "Who's that?" I went to the door and said, "It's I, Miss Janet. I want a cup of tea for Miss McTavish." In a moment, Harris had thrown on some clothes and was out in the passage. She was always a quick-willing girl and very obliging. She said, it was black dark, and I could not see her, "Never you mind, Miss Janet. I'll light the fire and boil up the kettle in no time." "You need not do that," said I, "for there's some one at the fire already. Cook, I suppose."
"Not me, ma'am," said a sleepy voice from the interior of the bedroom. "I'm in my bed."
"Then who can it be?" I asked, for the banging and raking had become still more tremendous, and the thunder of the poker was just awful. "It must be Bella," said Harris, feeling her way to the kitchen door and pushing it open, followed by me. We stood for a full half a minute in the dark, while she felt about and groped for the matches, and still the noise continued. "Bella," I said crossly, "what on earth?" But at this instant the match was struck, and dimly lit up the kitchen. I strained my eyes into the darkness, while Harris composedly lit a candle. I looked, and looked, and looked again, but there was no one in the kitchen but ourselves. I was just petrified, I can tell you, and I staggered against the dresser and gaped at the now silent fireplace. The coals and cinders and ashes were exactly as they had gone out, not a bit disturbed. Anyone could see that they had never been stirred. "In the name of goodness, Harris," I said in a whisper, "where is the person that was poking that fire? You heard them yourself."
"I heard a noise, sure enough, Miss Janet," she said, not a bit daunted, "and if I were a body that believed in ghosts and such like clowers, I'd say it was them," putting firewood in the grate as she spoke. "It's queer, certainly. Miss McTavish will be wearying for her tea," she added. "I know well what it is to have a kind of longing for a good cup. Save us, what a cold air there is in this kitchen. I wonder where cook put the bellows."
Seeing that Harris was taking the matter so coolly, for very shame I was forced to do the like, so I did not say a word about my misgivings, nor the odd queer thrill I had felt as we stood in the pitch darkness and listened to the furious raking of the kitchen grate. How icy cold the kitchen had been, just like a vault, and with the same damp, earthy smell. I was in a mighty hurry to get back upstairs, believe me, and did all in my power to speed the fire and the kettle, and in due time we wended our way above, Harris bearing the tea on a tray and walking last. I left it to administer the refreshment while I went into Bella's room, which was close by, candle in hand. "You are awake, I see, Bella," I remarked, putting it down as I spoke. I felt that I must unbosom myself to someone, or never close an eye that night. "Tell me, did you hear a great raking of the kitchen fire just now?"
"Yes, miss, of course."
"Why, it woke me. I suppose you had occasion to go down for something, Miss Janet. But why did you not call me?"
"It was not I who woke you, Bella," I rejoined quickly. "I was on my way downstairs when I heard that noise below, and I thought it was cook or Harris. But when I got down, Harris came out of the bedroom. Cook was in bed. Maggie, you know, is up above you, and we went into the kitchen thinking it might be you or her, and lit a candle. But I give you my word of honor that although the noise was still terrible till we struck a light, when we looked about us, not a soul was to be seen." At this, Bella started up in bed and became of a livid, chalky kind of color.
"No one, Miss Janet?" she gasped out.
"Not a soul," I replied solemnly.
"Then, oh," she exclaimed, now jumping bodily out on the floor and looking quite wild and distracted, "tell me in heaven's name, which of you went into the kitchen first, you or Harris?" She was so agitated she seemed scarcely able to bring out the words, and her eyes rested upon mine with a strange, frightened look that made me fancy she had taken temporary leave of her wits.
"Harris went first," I answered shortly. "Thank heaven for that," she returned, not collapsing on the edge of her bed. "But poor Kate Harris is a dead woman." I stared hard at Bella, as well I might. Was she talking in her sleep, or was I dreaming? "What do you mean, Bella Cameron?" I cried. "Are you gone crazy? Are you gone clean daft?" "It was a warning," she replied, in a low and awestruck voice. "We Highlanders understand the like well. It was a warning of death. Katie Harris's hour has come." "If you're going to talk such wicked nonsense, Bella," I said, "I am not going to stop to listen. Whatever you do, don't let Matilda hear you going on with such foolishness. The house would not hold her, and you know that well." "All right, Miss Janet, you heard the commotion yourself. You will allow that, and you will see that the kitchen grate is never raked out for nothing. I only wish from the bottom of my heart that what I've told you may not come true, but bad as it was, I'm thankful that you were not first in the kitchen." A few more indignant expostulations on my part and lamentations on Bella's, and then I went back to Matilda, and it being now near 3 o'clock, and she inclined to be drowsy, I lay down on the sofa and got a couple of hours' sleep. A day or two afterwards, I was suddenly struck with a strange thrill of apprehension by noticing how very ill Kate Harris looked. I taxed her with not feeling well, and she admitted that she had not been herself and could not say what ailed her. She had no actual pain, but she felt weak all over and could scarcely drag herself about the house. It would go off. She would not see a doctor. No. It was only just a kind of cold feeling in her bones, and a sort of notion that a hand was gripping her throat. It was all fancy, and Dr. Henderson, our doctor, would make fine game of her if he saw her by way of being a patient. She would be all right in a day or two. Vain hope. In a day or two she was much worse. She was obliged to give in, to take to her bed. I sent for Dr. Henderson. Indeed, he called daily to visit Mattie, so I had only to pilot him down below to see Kate. He came out to me presently with a very grave face and said, "Has she any friends?" pointing toward Kate's door with his thumb. "Friends, to be sure," I answered. "She has a sister married to a tramp conductor in Wickham Street." "Send for her at once, and you had better have her moved. She can't last a week." "Do you mean that she is going to die?" I gasped, clutching the bolsters, for we were standing in the lower hall. "I am sorry to say the case is hopeless. Nothing can save her, and the sooner she is with her own people, the better." I was, I need scarcely tell you, greatly shocked, terribly shocked. And presently, when I recovered myself, I sent off post-haste for Kate's sister. I wanted to see her. She, poor creature, was all curiosity to know what the doctor said. "He would tell me nothing, miss," she observed smilingly. "Only felt my pulse and tried my heart with a stethoscope, and my temperature with that queer little tube. I only feel a bit tired and out of breath, but you'll find I'll be all right in a day or two. I'm only sorry I'm giving all this trouble, and Bella and Mary having to do my work. However, I'll be fit to clean the place on Sunday." Poor soul, little did she dream that her work in this world was done. And I, as I sat beside the bed and looked at her always pale face, her now livid lips and hollow eyes, told myself that already I could see the hand of death on her countenance. I was obliged to tell her sister what the doctor had said, and how she cried, and so did I. And who was to tell Kate? We wished to keep her with us undisturbed, Matilda and I, but her people would not hear of it, and so we had an ambulance from the hospital and sent her home. She just lived a week, and strange to say, she had always the greatest craving for me to be with her, for me to sit beside her and read to her and hold her hand. She showed far more anxiety for my company than for that of any of her own people. Bella alone, of all the household, expressed no astonishment when she heard the doctor's startling verdict. Being in Mattie's room at the time, she merely looked over at me gravely and significantly shook her head. One evening, Bella and I were with her. She had lain silent for a long time, and then she said to me quite suddenly, "Miss Janet, you'll remember that morning you came downstairs looking for Miss McTavish's tea?" Then I not recollect it only too well. Somehow I got a queer kind of chill then. I felt it at the time, to the very marrow of my bones. I've never been warm since. It was just this day, fortnight. I remember it well, because it was washing Monday. That night, Kate Harris died. She passed away, as it were, in her sleep, with her hand in mine, as she was with me on that mysterious night, so I was now with her. Call me a superstitious old imbecile, or what you like, but I firmly believe that had I entered that kitchen first, it would have been Janet McTavish, and not Kate Harris, who was lying in her coffin. Of course, Matilda knows nothing of this, nor ever will. Perhaps, for she is one of your strong-minded folk, she would scout at the idea, and at me, for a daft, silly body, and try to explain it all away quite reasonable-like. I only wish she could. No Eyewitnesses by Henry S. Whitehead. There were bloodstains on Everard Simon's shoes. Simon's father had given up his country house in Rye when his wife died and moved into an apartment in Flatbush among the rising apartment houses which were steadily replacing the original rural atmosphere of that residential section of swelling Brooklyn. Bloodstains and forest mold on his shoes. The younger Simon, he was 37, his father getting on toward 70, always spent his winters in the West Indies, returning in the spring, going back again in October. He was a popular writer of informative magazine articles. As soon as his various visits for week's end and odd days were concluded, he would move his trunks into the Flatbush apartment and spend a week or two, sometimes longer, with his father. There was a room for him in the apartment, and this he would occupy until it was time for him to leave for his summer camp and the Andradacs. Early in September he would repeat the process, always ending his autumn stay in the United States with his father until it was time to sail back to St. Thomas or Martinique, or wherever he imagined he could write best for that particular winter. There was only one drawback in this arrangement. This was the long ride in the subway necessitated by his dropping into his New York club every day. The club was his real American headquarters. There he received his mail. There he usually lunched and often dined as well. It was at the club that he received his visitors and his telephone calls. The club was on 44th Street, and to get there from the apartment he walked to the Church Avenue subway station, changed at DeKalb Avenue, and then took a Times Square express train over the Manhattan Bridge. The time consumed between the door of the apartment and the door of the club was exactly 3/4 hour, barring delays. For the older man the arrangement was ideal. He could be in his office, he boasted, in 20 minutes. To avoid the annoyances of rush hours in the subway, Mr. Simon Sr. commonly left home quite early in the morning, about 7 o'clock. He was a methodical person, always leaving before 7 in the morning and getting his breakfast in a downtown restaurant near the office. Everard Simon rarely left the apartment until after 9, thus avoiding the morning rush hour at its other end. During the 5 or 6 weeks every year that they lived together, the two men really saw each other very little, although strong bonds of understanding, affection, and respect bound them together. Sometimes the older man would awaken his son early in the morning for a brief conversation. Occasionally, the two would have a meal together, evenings or on Sundays. Now and then an evening would be spent in each other's company. They had little to converse about. During the day they would sometimes call each other up and speak together briefly on the telephone, from club to office or office to club. On the day when Everard Simon sailed south, his father and he always took a farewell luncheon together somewhere downtown. On the day of his return 7 months later, his father always made it a point to meet him at the dock. These arrangements had prevailed for 11 years. He must get that blood wiped off. Blood. How? During that period, the neighborhood of the apartment had changed out of all recognition. Open lots, community tennis courts, and many of the older one-family houses had disappeared, to be replaced by the ubiquitous apartment houses. In 1928, the neighborhood, which had been almost rural when the older Simon had taken up his abode 20 minutes from his Wall Street office, was solidly built up except for an occasional and now incongruous frame house standing lonely and dwarfed in its own grounds among the towering apartment houses, like a lost child in a preoccupied crowd of adults whose business caused them to look over the child's head. One evening, not long before the end of his autumn sojourn in Flatbush, Everard Simon, having dined alone in his club, started for Times Square subway station about 9:15. Doubled together lengthwise and pressing the pocket of his coat out of shape was a magazine, out that day, which contained one of his articles. He stepped on board a waiting Sea Beach Express train in the rearmost car, sat down, and opened the magazine, looking down the table of contents to find his article. The train started after the ringing of the warning bell and the automatic closing of the side doors. While he was putting on his reading spectacles, he began on the article. He was dimly conscious of the slight bustle of incoming passengers at Broadway and Canal Street, and again when the train ran out on the Manhattan Bridge, because of the change in the light. But his closing of the magazine with a page corner turned down, and the replacing of the spectacles in his inside pocket when the train drew into DeKalb Avenue were almost entirely mechanical. He could make that change almost without thought. He had to cross a platform here at DeKalb Avenue, get into a Brighton Beach local train. The Brighton Beach Express ran only in rush hours, and he almost never traveled during those periods. He got into his train, found a seat, and resumed his reading. He paid no attention to the stations, Atlantic and 7th Avenues. The next stop after that, Prospect Park, would give him one of his mechanical signals, like coming out on the bridge. The train emerged from its tunnel at Prospect Park, only to re-enter it again at Parkside Avenue, the next following station. After that came Church Avenue, where he got out every evening. As the train drew in that station, he repeated the mechanics of turning down a page in the magazine, replacing his spectacles in their case, and putting the case in his inside pocket. His mind entirely on the article, he got up, left the train, walked back toward the Carlton Avenue exit, started to mount the stairs. A few moments later, he was walking, his mind still entirely occupied with his article in the long, familiar direction of his father's apartment. The first matter which reminded him of his surroundings was a contrast in his breathing after the somewhat stuffy air of the subway train. Consciously, he drew in a deep breath of the fresh, sweet outdoor air. There was a spicy odor of wet leaves about it somehow. It seemed, as he noticed his environment, with the edge of his mind darker than usual. The crossing of Church and Catton Avenues was a brightly lighted corner. Possibly something was temporarily wrong with the lighting system. He looked up. Great trees nodded above his head. He could see the stars twinkling above their lofty tops. The sickle edge of a moon cut sharply against black branches moving gently, and a fresh wind from the sea. He walked down several steps before he paused, slackened his gait, then stopped dead, his mind responding in a note of quiet wonderment. Great trees stood all about him. From some distance ahead, a joyous song in a manly bass, slightly muffled by the wood of the thick trees, came to his ears. It was a song new to him. He found himself listening to it eagerly. The song was entirely strange to him, the words unfamiliar. He listened intently. The singer came nearer. He caught various words, English words. He distinguished Mary and heart and repine. It seemed entirely natural to be here, and yet, as he glanced down at his brown clothes, his highly polished shoes, felt the magazine bulging his pocket, the edge of his mind caught a note of incongruity. He remembered with a smile that strange drawing of Aubrey Beardsley, of a lady playing an upright cottage pianoforte in the midst of a field of daisies. He stood, he perceived in a kind of rough path worn by long usage. The ground was damp underfoot, already his polished shoes were soiled with mold. The singer came nearer and nearer. Obviously, on the fresh voice indicated, it was a young man. Just as the voice presaged that before many seconds the singer must come out of the screening array of tree boles, Everett Simon was startled by a crashing, quite nearby at his right. The singer paused in the middle of a note, and for an instant there was a primeval silence undisturbed by the rustle of a single leaf. Then a huge timber wolf burst through the underbrush to the right, paused, crouched, and sprang in a direction diagonal to that in which Everett Simon was facing, toward the singer. Startled into a frigid immobility, Simon stood as though petrified. He heard an exclamation in the singer's voice, a quick, ah, and then the sound of a struggle. The great wolf apparently had failed to knock down his quarry. Then, without warning, the two figures, man and wolf, came into plain sight. The singer, for so Simon thought of him, a tall, robust fellow, in fringed deerskin, slashing desperately with a hunting knife, The beast, crouching now, snapping with a tearing motion of a great punishing jaw. Short breaths came from the man as he parried dexterously the lashing snaps of the wicked jaws. The two revolving about each other came very close. Everett Simon watched the struggle, fascinated, motionless. Suddenly the animal shifted its tactics. It backed away stealthily, preparing for another spring. The young woodsman abruptly dropped his knife, reached for the great pistol which depended from his belt in a rough leather holster. There was a blinding flash, and the wolf slithered down, its legs giving under it. A great cloud of acrid smoke drifted about Everett Simon, cutting off his vision, choking smoke, which made him cough. But through it he saw the look of horrified wonderment on the face of the young woodsman, saw the pistol drop on the damp ground as the knife had dropped, followed with his eyes through the dimming medium of the hanging smoke, the fascinated, round-eyed stare of the man who had fired the pistol. There, a few feet away from him, he saw an eldritch change passing over the beast, shivering now in its death struggle. He saw the hair of the great paws dissolve, the jaws shorten and shrink, the lithe body buckle and heave strangely. He closed his eyes, and when he opened them, he saw the figure in deerskin standing mutely over the body of a man, lying prone across tree roots, a pool of blood spreading from the concealed face, mingling with the damp earth under the tree roots. Then the strange spell of quiescence, which had held him in its weird thrall, was dissolved, and moved by a nameless terror, he ran, wildly, straight down the narrow path between the trees. It seemed to him that he had been running only a short distance when something, the moon above the trees perhaps, began to increase in size to give a more brilliant light. He slackened his pace. The ground now felt firm underfoot, no longer damp, slippery. Other lights joined that of the moon. Things became brighter all about him, and as this brilliance increased, the great trees all about him turned dim and pale. The ground was now quite hard underfoot. He looked up. A brick wall faced him. It was pierced with windows. He looked down. He stood on pavement. Overhead, a street light swung lightly in the late September breeze. A faint smell of wet leaves was in the air, mingled now with a fresh wind from the sea. The magazine was clutched tightly in his left hand. He had, it appeared, drawn it from his pocket. He looked at it curiously, put it back into the pocket. He stepped along over familiar pavement, past well-known facades. The entrance to his father's apartment loomed before him. Mechanically, he thrust his left hand into his trouser pockets. He took out his key, opened a door, traversed the familiar hallway with its rugs and marble walls and bracket side wall light clusters. He mounted the stairs one flight, turned a corner, reached the door of the apartment, let himself in with his key. It was 9:30, and his father had already retired. They talked through the old man's bedroom door, monosyllabically. The conversation ended with a request from his father that he close the bedroom door. He did so after wishing the old man good night. He sat down in an armchair in the living room, passed a hand over his forehead, bemused. He sat for 15 minutes, then he reached into his pocket for a cigarette. They were all gone. Then he remembered that he had meant to buy a fresh supply on his way to the apartment. He had meant to get the cigarettes from the drugstore between the Church Avenue subway station and the apartment. He looked about the room for one. His father's supply, too, seemed depleted. He rose, walked into the entry, put on his hat, stepped out again into the hallway, descended the one flight, went out into the street. He walked into an unwanted atmosphere of excitement. People were conversing as they passed, in excited tones, about the drugstore entrance. A crowd was gathered. Slightly puzzled, he walked toward it, paused, blocked on the outer edge. "What's happened?" he inquired of a young man he found standing just beside him, a little to the fore. "It's a shooting of some kind," the young man explained. "I only just got here myself. The fellow that got bumped off is inside the drugstore. What's left of him? Some gang war stuff, I guess." He walked away, skirting the rounded edge of the clustering crowd of curiosity mongers, proceeded down the street, procured the cigarettes elsewhere. He passed the now large crowd on the other side of the street on his way back, returned to the apartment where he sat, smoking and thinking, until 11, when he retired. Curious. A man shot. just at the time, or about the time, he had let that imagination of his get the better of him. Those trees. His father wakened him about 5 minutes before 7. The old man held a newspaper in his hand. He pointed to a scarehead on the front page. "This must have happened about the time you came in," remarked Mr. Simon. "Yes, the crowd was around the drugstore when I went out to get some cigarettes," replied Everett Simon, stretching and yawning. When his father was gone, and he had finished with his bath, he sat down in a bathrobe to glance over the newspaper count. A phrase arrested him. The body was identified as that of Jerry the Wolf, a notorious gangster with a long prison record. Then lower down, when he had resumed his reading, a large caliber bullet, which, entering the lower jaw, penetrated the base of the brain. No eyewitnesses. Everett Simon sat for a long time after he had finished the account, the newspaper on the floor by his chair. No eyewitnesses? He must really keep that imagination of his within bounds, within his control. Slowly and reflectively, this good resolution uppermost, he went back to the bathroom and prepared for his morning shave. Putting on his shoes in his room, he observed something amiss. He picked up a shoe, examined it carefully. The soles of the shoes were caked with black mold, precisely like the mold from the wood paths about his Andranak camp. Little weathered leaves and dried pine needles clung to the mold, and on the side of the right shoe were brownish stains, exactly like freshly dried bloodstains. He shuddered as he carried the shoes into the bathroom, wiped them clean with a damp towel, then rinsed out the towel. He put them on, and shortly afterward, before he entered the subway to go over to the club for the day, he had them polished. The boot black spoke of the killing on that corner the night before. The boot black noticed something amiss with the shoes, and when he had finished, there was no trace of any stains. Simon did not change at DelKalb Avenue that morning. An idea had occurred to him between Church Avenue and DelKalb, and he stayed on the Brighton local, secured a seat after the emptying process which took place at DelKalb, and went on through the East River Tunnel. He sent in his name to Forrest, a college acquaintance, now in the district attorney's office, and Forrest received him after a brief delay. "I want to ask a detail about this gangster who was killed in Flatbush last night," said Simon. "I suppose you have his record, haven't you?" "Yes. We know pretty well about him. What particular thing did you want to know?"
"About his name," replied Simon. "Why was he called Jerry the Wolf? That is, why the Wolf particularly?"
"That's the very queer thing, Simon. Such a name is not really uncommon. There was that fellow Goddard, you remember. They called him the Wolf of Wall Street. There was a fictional criminal known as the Lone Wolf. There have been plenty of wolves among criminal monikers. But this fellow, Jerry Gorafsky, was a Hungarian, really. He was called the Wolf, queerly enough, because there were those in his gang who believed he was one of those birds who could change himself into a wolf. It's a queer combination, isn't it, for a New York gangster?"
"Yes," said Everett Simon. "It is very queer. When you come to think of it, I'm much obliged to you for telling me. I was curious about it somehow."
"That isn't the only queer aspect of this case, however," resumed Forrest, a light frown suddenly showing on his keen face. "In fact, that wolf thing isn't part of the case. Doesn't concern us, of course, here in the district attorney's office. That's nothing but blah. Gangsters are as superstitious as sailors. More so, in fact. No, the real mystery in this affair is the bullet, Simon. Want to see it?"
"Why, yes, of course. If you like, Forrest, what's wrong with the bullet?"
Forrest stepped out of the room, returned at once, laid a large round ball on his desk. Both men bent over it curiously. "Notice that diameter, Simon," said Forrest. "It's a hand-molded round ball. Belongs in a collection of curios. Not in any gangster's gat. Why, man, it's like the slugs they used to hunt the bison before the old Sharp's rifle was invented. It's a kind of a ball Fenmore Cooper's people use. Deerslayer, it would take a young cannon to throw that thing. Smashed in the whole front of Jerry's ugly mug. The inside works of his head were spilled all over the sidewalk. It's what the newspapers always call a clue. Who do you suppose resurrected the horse pistol, or the ship's blunderbuss, to do that job on Jerry? Clever in a way. Hooked it out of some dime museum, perhaps.
There are still a few of these old pitches still operating, you know. At the old stand along East 14th Street.
A flintlock. Single-shot horse pistol, I'd imagine, said Everett Simon, laying the ounce lead ball back on the mahogany desk. He knew something of weapons, new and old. As a writer of informational articles, that was part of his permanent equipment.
Very likely, mused the assistant district attorney. Glad you came in, old man.
And Everett Simon went on uptown to his club.